Well, this is sort of the second half of what Cheryl and I want to share with you. Yesterday, just to recap, we talked broadly about something that Lawrence also just mentioned, the broad gap between science and our culture. What we didn't mention is that ours is a historically grounded argument. As you probably know, 50 years ago, C.P. Snow gave us what I call a memo about warring tribes of eggheads, in which he warned us that, you know, literary intellectuals and natural scientists were having an incredibly hard time communicating. They shared very different assumptions, and those different assumptions polarized them and made them unable to share ideas, and this was damaging for the world. What we're trying to do is actually update that argument 50 years later, and in updating it, one important point is that literary intellectuals probably not that influential as they were in C.P. Snow's time. He actually argued that they were running British society. Some people questioned that, but he did make that argument in 1959. Nowadays, I don't think they're running anything. I'm not sure scientists are talking to them enough. But I know that scientists aren't talking enough to several groups that really are important, culturally influential today: the politicians, the journalists, the entertainers, the entertainment media, and the religious community. So how do we close this gap? I'm going to briefly address closing the science-politics gap, spend most of my time on the science-media gap then. We're going to leave entertainment and religion aside. And then Cheryl's going to come in and talk about a different aspect of solving the problem, and that is looking at the scientific workforce perspective and showing how current trends in science higher education in the U.S. are kind of an opportunity in disguise if we want to train a generation of culture crossers, science ambassadors who can actually reach out to different sectors of society. So let's talk about the science-politics gap first. I think the nature of the problem here is sort of nicely summarized in a quotation, unintentional, by George W. Bush. This was his first public comment following the tsunami catastrophe in 2004, and a journalist asked him at the press conference, you know, "Mr. President, does the United States have a warning system in place for the purpose of detecting tsunamis?" And Bush stammered, and he said, "Well, you know, I think we're probably not as vulnerable as they are in other parts of the world, but I'm not a geologist, as you know." And I think that is the nature of the problem. So this is why we need scientific advice. The government, one thing we can do then to reconnect the world of science and the world of politics is to restore strong scientific advice. National Academies is calling for this in a recent report at the presidential level. The Engaged Republicans in 1995 did away with their scientific advisory office, the Office of Technology Assessment. In my book, Republican War on Science, I called it a stunning act of self-lobotomy. We should also bring back the congressional science advisors, and we should look at science advice throughout the federal government. But in this time of information overload, where there's countless think tanks, countless institutes, universities, blogs, members of Congress and their staffs can get scientific information from anywhere, I'm not naive enough to really think that even if we had the Office of Technology Assessment back and it was doing its great work again, that someone like James Inhofe, right, who calls global warming one of the greatest hoaxes ever perpetrated against humankind or something to that effect, would be listening to the good science rather than cherry-picking something bad. So there's a lot more that we have to do, and I can't talk about all the solutions Cheryl and I have thought about, but one of them is I think we need more science-savvy legislators in Congress to begin with, more people like Princeton's Rush Holt, physicist, and his constituents drive around with bumper stickers reading, "My congressman is a rocket scientist." So we need more of this kind of person. How do we get that? Old-fashioned politics. It continues to astonish me why there is no pro-science political action committee, why wealthy people who care about science don't create an organization that targets 10 races. 5 pro-science candidates get money, 5 anti-science candidates, their opponents get money. And you put the money in the races, and you might combine this, not institutionally, but with something like Science Debate 2008 applied to congressional races. You would try to make science policy debates occur in the context of these congressional or Senate races, and you try to get more people who care about science. They don't have to be scientists, although some of them might end up being, but they could just be science-friendly representatives, someone like Brad Miller from the Research Triangle area, who's not a scientist, or Henry Waxman, who's a leader in defending science in Congress. So those are the kinds of things that I think we need to do to reconnect science and politics, and it really requires activism on the part of the scientific community, because we're the ones who know what they're missing. They don't necessarily know that they're not getting the broadest sense of the scientific relevance, the relevance of science to the issues. And that's why the message has to be brought to them. But then there's another problem, reaching out to the media, and I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this. I'm probably going to have to go quick. I really think that science and journalism, another classic two cultures divide in the C.P. Snowian sense, and I'll just show you some data that I think pretty much shows this. This is the week of January 29th, Pew Data, 2007, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth assessment report had just come out. Global warming is unequivocal. Human caused, of course, very likely at this point. So how much media attention does it get? According to Pew, this is the orange bars on the left. 5% of total news coverage that week, and in terms of what people are actually paying interest to, what they're following closely, it did better than that. The next week, though, global warming, and this is a report that only comes out once every 5 years, global warming's knocked out of the news by, among other things, the death of Anna Nicole Smith, the Super Bowl, and the bizarre story of an astronaut love triangle that ultimately led to criminal charges. So you probably remember that, right? I mean, that's the effect of the media. Why are there two cultures? Why are scientists and journalists polarized? Lawrence are unable to communicate enough. Lawrence mentioned some of the important reasons. I'm just going to run through some others quick. I've sort of written a book chapter about this recently. So what do journalists think of scientists? You know, this is a report where they were surveyed. Not accessible, so immersed in their own jargon they can't communicate. Malcolm Jones in Newsweek showing the prejudice when he wrote that Darwin was hardly even a scientist in the sense we understand the term today, a highly trained specialist whose professional vocabulary is so arcane he or she can only talk to other scientists. So it's prejudice on the journalistic side. Well, what do the scientists think of the journalists? They don't like them much either. It's the same report. 90% thought they didn't understand science and technology. Another study for the UK, very low confidence of scientists in British science journalists or newspaper journalists. Union of Concerned Scientists, they poll their members, and 90% say the media does a bad job with science. Well, why does this happen? Because journalists' professional norms don't necessarily mesh with the scientific process very well. Lawrence mentioned the problem of balance. And that's one of the areas where the media wants, on the one hand and on the other hand, some scientific issues don't really shake out that way. Media coverage is often event-driven, episodic, so they'll pounce on a study, and then they'll pounce on the study that contradicts it 6 months later, and members of the public are like, you know, mad at the journalists and the scientists, actually, because of this. And of course, they're just trying to find the new rather than teasing out the full implications. And there's a lot of other issues on the journalist side, but then what about the scientist side? They have unrealistic expectations of journalists. This is a study of Dutch scientists. Part of it was published in Nature. 80% thought journalists should comprehensively present scientific research, as if there's space and time. 90% thought that the journalists must allow scientists to check their articles for accuracy prior to publication. Okay, again, a time problem and also a journalistic objectivity problem. They don't want to be showing the source the information. That could be contrary to journalistic conduct, though in some cases I'm willing to do it, and other journalists are too. Some of the scientists half even thought the journalists would be obliged to check the information with the scientists prior to publication. Never going to happen. Okay, so let's not be unrealistic about this on either side. So in the end, each side thinks of the other in caricature. Here's the caricature of the scientist, and here's, you know, the journalist, just me, 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 this story, this story, this story. In fact, of course, it's not really like that. How do we break down the divide? Well, first thing we've got to do is let's think about actually training scientists in how the media works and how to be good communicators. There was actually legislation by Doris Matsui from California. It was the Scientific Communication Act 2007. It was going to tell NSF to allocate funds for graduate science students training communication, got rolled into America Competes, and then got no dollars attached to it. So it hasn't happened yet. But this is the kind of thing that we need. I've been doing a couple of trainings. I did Caltech this year and also something at UCSD, trainings for science graduate students in communication. It actually turns out to be a lot of fun. We watch Brian Greene on the Colbert Report, and we see what science communication at the highest level really is. You know, how do you deal with it when someone says to you, science, what's the big deal? What did it ever do for me? You know, which is what Colbert said. And he's like, science fiction, yeah, that's cool, but that's because you've got large-breasted alien robots. You know? And Brian Greene did a great job with this kind of stuff. But the students in the chair, you know, I interview them, and I act like an idiot. And, you know, there was a student I was interviewing about nanotech, and I said, I'm really interested in the fashion implications, you know. I mean, can my jeans change color? Can my shirt change? And some of them stop talking. They can't deal with the craziness of what a media interview might be like. So let's get them more familiar with that kind of process. And then last, I'll just end with this point. We're also going to need high-level strategic communication informed by communication scholars, informed by research, to reach the public on the really hot-button issues. And this is, to do this, you have to frame scientific information. That's what I argue with Matt Nisbet in Science. I'll run through the argument very briefly and then turn over to Cheryl so she can talk about the scientific workforce. Nisbet's argument, he's a professor of communication at American. He says, broadly speaking, members of the public are cognitive misers. What that means is there's not enough time to be fully informed about every issue that's important much less every scientific issue, most of which are complex. So in the absence of the ability to be fully informed, and this is true of all of us, right? I'm not fully informed about every issue. It's impossible to be. There's too much information. So how do we make up our minds? We use shortcuts. We self-select sources of information that we agree with. And in the fragmented media that I showed you yesterday, you can select anything. You can select out of science entirely. You can select Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh to get your take on science. And you trust it. You can listen to your neighbor who's an anti-evolutionist, and that's what you trust. How do you reach the public that's getting information this way that doesn't really understand the issues and doesn't have time for the complexity? In fact, the complexity is a turnoff. Well, you take the complexity, you pare it down, and you emphasize just those aspects of the complexity that are relevant to the audience. And then you study the media, and you reach the different segments of the audience through the media outlets that they actually attend to with the messages they attend to. Expensive, complicated, requires research, yes, but this is what people do in politics. And if you really want to reach people, you have to think about something similar. I'll just end with global warming. One of the reasons there's been progress on the issue and we're on the verge of solving it, I think, in the next administration is because it's been reframed. Conservatives for a very long time framed it as a matter of scientific uncertainty. Here's the infamous Frank Luntz memo saying to Republicans, you need to tell voters there's no consensus on the science. Continue to make the lack of certainty a primary issue in the debate. And that's what they did for years and years and years, picking over every little detail, misleading about the body of mainstream understanding and the consilience of the evidence. If global warming has moved, it's in part because the issue's been reframed. And so now there are different narratives out there that aren't science intensive, that aren't technical. One of them that mobilizes at least some evangelicals is this idea is that there's a religious moral duty to address global warming. Note that the science hasn't changed. The science just isn't part of the message anymore. We've reframed the issue. One that motivates the investor class, people who care about their 401ks. Global warming is an economic opportunity because the companies that are ready to make money once we get rid of carbon dioxide are going to be the ones you want to invest in now. And again, it gets away from the complexity of the science and the attacks on the science and shows us how we can progress on the issue and appeals to a different audience that might not have been interested in the core scientific information and the technical details. So that's the broad strategy that we need to embrace. And now I just want to shift over to Cheryl, who's going to talk about how we can train some of the people we're going to need to do that and how the problems with the scientific workforce and the scientific pipeline are actually an opportunity in disguise if we want to reconnect science and culture. And I think she's going to start with a clip.
Thanks, Chris. Mm-hmm. Again, The Simpsons.
So much empathy for those villagers. They had to drink their own tears.
I was so bored I cut the ponytail off the guy sitting in front of us. Look at me. I'm a grad student. I'm 30 years old, and I made $600 last year.
Brr, don't make fun of grad students. They just made a terrible life
choice. I don't know why it stopped. They just made a terrible life choice. And of course, that is our cultural icon, right? The Simpsons, with some commentary on grad students, but more really with some commentary on the scientific pipeline, how we are training the next leaders in science and engineering on this long and arduous road toward competing, toward being successful within the workforce. So as far as competitiveness, you know, everyone's questioning, and Lawrence spoke a lot earlier about young people in academia now. The U.S. still leads the world in total science and engineering PhD production. And the total numbers of PhDs received now is increasing. And we always hear about China. China's rate is far greater than ours in terms of rate, but we're still producing more numbers. The trouble is we might be ceding our lead. And what does that actually mean? Well, many are familiar with the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report by the National Academies of Sciences, which came out in 2005, and it concluded the scientific and technological building blocks critical to our economic leadership are eroding at a time when many other nations are gathering strength. So this isn't just a problem of jobs. This isn't just a problem of opportunities for a select group of individuals. What this really is something that's going to branch out with enormous socioeconomic repercussions unless we start paying more attention to changing the traditional way that we're thinking about educating these upcoming leaders in the science and engineering fields. But is the problem a question of numbers? Are more scientists better? Obviously, you know, yes, we want more people interested in science from an early age and beyond, but that alone isn't the solution to the problem. And if you just look at these numbers, a lot of numbers here, but I want you to focus in on just the bottom. This is the National Science Foundation report, the most recent indicator report. And as you can see, in each field, except for computer sciences, you can see the numbers are actually increasing. So we're producing more Bachelor of Science degrees than ever at the undergraduate level, and then again at the doctoral level. So it's not quite that we don't have enough interest in these fields right now. It's more a question of where do they go from here? And this is just a cartoon from PhD Comics, but this is the story of many of my peers and colleagues and friends right now in academia. They're so interested to pursue these avenues, and they want to go on. Many of them have different interests. Many of them are interested in biotech or different arenas. But you also have a lot of people who go in and they want to teach. They want to do what they've been studying. They want to impart that on the next generation beyond. And when you look at the way changing dynamic is in academia as far as hiring, there's all sorts of troubling trends. But the most troubling to me, I think, from the numbers I was looking at is this one: the probability that a PhD recipient now under 35 is going to obtain a tenure track job is at 7%. Now, that's not what a lot of people expect when they enter the pipeline much earlier. And that's scary to a lot of young, ambitious, science and engineering oriented students. And in a lot of ways, it limits what they can do later on. So we have a situation where more and more people are receiving the degrees and fewer opportunities are waiting for them at the end. This article in Nature came out in 2007, and specifically to biologists, but again, just evidence that we're producing more biologists, but tenure is staying static. The Urban Institute report in 2007 concluded that science and engineering occupations make up only 1/20 of all workers, and each year there are more than 3 times as many science and engineering 4-year college graduates as there are job openings. And another quote I just wanted to include, 1 to 2 years after graduation, 20% of science and engineering bachelors are in school but not in science and engineering studies, 45% working but in non-science and engineering employment, and 1 to 2 years after graduation, 7% of science and engineering master's graduates are enrolled in school but not enrolled in these areas, with another 31% working but not in science and engineering employment. So we're putting them in. Where are they going? But what we're calling for, what we see, is despite all these challenges, it's really a lot of opportunity in disguise. So what we want to suggest, Chris and I talk a lot about changing the paradigm. What we should be doing, what we are proposing as our candles, our solutions to all the problems we've been talking about for 2 days, especially a lot of what Lawrence highlighted earlier, we should be arming graduate students with skills to communicate the value of what we're doing and to get into better touch with culture, to really bridge the C.P. Snow science-culture gap. We want to develop a more diverse skill set to help them, you know, to help them be successful in today's job market, especially now. I mean, a lot of postdocs, early career scientists, are struggling. They're starting families. They need resources and they need support. So we want to imbue them with other opportunities, other ways to do what they do and to succeed so they can stay in science and engineering. Beyond the students themselves, we should be encouraging policymakers, leaders in the scientific community and beyond, philanthropists who care about the role of science, to create a new range of nonprofit, public interest fellowships, and job positions. And in doing so, that would connect science with other sectors of society, prioritizing politics, media, and entertainment, all these areas that have been so problematic, religion too, in a way that we're not achieving that now. But the raw material is there. And these are people who have more often than not, you know, called for wanting to engage more. And now more than ever, especially with initiatives like Science Debate 2008 And we're receiving emails all the time from young people who are very ambitious and who want to participate, and they're just not sure how. And in the traditional academic setting, they're not even given a lot of the opportunities to get these skills and to move further into, you know, having a broader impact beyond an ivory tower, beyond biotech industry. So what we're basically saying is, here's the science pipeline. Let's create some new valves. Let's release some of all this pent-up expertise, this pent-up steam, because the numbers are there. So we're calling for more interdisciplinary opportunities. We'd like to foster a broader set of abilities, enhance scientific communication, create more outreach experts. And that's not to say everyone has to do this. I mean, we're thinking a small percentage even could have a dramatic impact. Look at Carl Sagan, a single person who had a tremendous impact on an entire generation, if not more. And so, by doing this, we would see new jobs, but we'd still see a strong division of labor and research and a strong, you know, new group of science ambassadors to really make these connections and bridge the culture gap and progress research and outreach. So thank you.